War in the Democratic Republic of Congo officially ended 5 years ago, but an estimated 45,000 people continue to die there every month. With me now for today's Underreported are Dr. Richard J. Brennan, Health Director of the International Rescue Committee, and IRC researcher Alyosha D'Onofrio, who joins us by phone from Bukavu in the South Kivu region of eastern Congo, which is close to the border of Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good evening.
And let's begin with you, Dr. Brennan. What have most of these 45,000 people dying each month been dying from?
Well, the majority have been dying from what we would call easily preventable and treatable diseases, such as diarrhea, pneumonia, malaria, and a significant proportion also from tuberculosis and neonatal deaths, children dying within 28 days of birth. Most of these conditions are people rarely die of in the West.
So they're not dying through the violent conflict?
In fact, violence only caused about less than 0.5% of the deaths. So these are what we call the indirect consequences, health consequences of conflict. Conflict can disrupt health and livelihoods through disruption of the economy and breakdown of health systems and disruption of the food supply. And so these are what we call the indirect consequences, but they're no less devastating than the violence itself.
Well, how much real fighting is going on in the region these days?
Well, Alyosha is probably a better place to answer that right now.
Alyosha, you want to answer that? And also, perhaps, and then we'll do a little background for our listeners on, because not everyone is familiar with this complicated situation.
Certainly. Thank you. Well, when you ask the question how much fighting is going on right now, I think the first important thing to be aware is that the fighting that we've experienced in the Congo over the last year has been in a relatively localized area. This is the area of North Kivu, a few hundred kilometers north of where I am now. And this has engaged about four different major armed groups, including the Congolese army and a number of rebel factions that have been fighting over contested territory there over the last year. And in the course of that, it's an estimated 400,000 people have been displaced from their homes as a result of that fighting. And this, you know, as Dr. Brennan just said, in addition to the disruptive consequences of the prior wars and the breakdown of the health system, the breakdown of trading routes and so on and so forth. In addition to all that, this displacement from active fighting has put people in a very, very difficult position in terms of their access to clean drinking water, their access to appropriate forms of nutrition and so on. And so this, in turn, exacerbates people's susceptibility to common diseases, and which would, in other circumstances would be easily preventable or treatable.
Well, why does war continue there if it officially ended 5 years ago?
Well, we've seen sporadic conflict throughout the eastern part of the Congo since the end of the official war. For the most part, this has been the continuation of conflict over access to resources. The Congo, as many of us know, the Congo is one of the most rich countries in terms of its natural resources. It has huge mineral deposits, which have really been a major motor for the conflict, a major target of the various armed groups.
So this is less about political ideology than it is about who's going to be able to take advantage of all these natural resources?
Political ideology gets wrapped up in that, and very quickly there is a polarization. You know, that we've seen the polarization of different groups around ethnicity or assumed ethnicity of the participants. We've seen different ideas and concepts put forward by different parts of the war, different warring factions. But ultimately, this is a conflict over resources, and I think that fits as a major root cause for the ongoing conflicts that we see in the East. And in the sense, I think the other aspect of this is that, of course, once you get prolonged conflict like this, it starts to get a dynamic of its own, and so there is a certain amount of posturing and positions being taken and tit for tat retaliations that tends to then exacerbate and give another dimension to the conflict, be it ethnic, be it ideological. But, you know, like I said, at root cause, there's been a big struggle over natural resources.
Well, it's often described as the result of a spillover from the genocide in Rwanda. But I should also point out that there's a big, there's a certain gap because of the connection to the telephone in Congo. But so don't be surprised that we have these long pauses. Go ahead, Alyosha.
So in answer to the question about the spillover from the events of 1994 in Rwanda, then yes, it is certainly the case that there have been and continue to be armed groups in eastern Congo that are associated with or came from that period and that conflict in Rwanda. It is, I believe, and from the observations that one makes in terms of contact with a variety of other people that work in this context, I believe that is, while it is still used, and you hear about this in the rhetoric of different participants and different parties to this conflict, I don't think that's really the root cause now. I think what you have is some very firmly entrenched groups around mineral resources, and they have become used to extracting the wealth from these resources, and it's very hard to dislodge people from that context. And so really, you know, within the context of the post-war recovery of the Congolese state, we still see the playing out of the long-term effects of some of these earlier conflicts.
Now, just to an outsider, this whole thing can be rather confusing. What you've just described clears up a lot of the confusion because we only get this information from news reports, often very, very brief news reports. But there's a whole matter of the name Congo, isn't there? There are two countries that are called Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Congo. We're talking only about the Democratic Republic of Congo here.
Absolutely, yes. That was known as Zaire for many years under the rule of Mobutu, but which has been called the Democratic Republic of Congo since the fall of Mobutu and the accession to power of Laurent Désiré Kabila, the father of the current president, the first democratically elected president in a generation, Joseph Kabila.
I'm talking with IRC researcher Alyosha D'Onofrio, who's talking to us by phone from Bukavu in South Kivu, a region in eastern Congo, not far from the fighting in North Kivu. It's close to the border of Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi. And also with us is Dr. Richard J. Brennan, health director of the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. Dr. Brennan, how have civilians become a major part of this conflict? I said that an estimated 5.4 million people have died in Congo since 1998. And to put that in context, that's the population of the entire country of Denmark. It's the most people to die in a war since World War II. They've all been dying because they've been displaced?
Well, not entirely. This most recent study that we've released this week is the fifth mortality survey that we've done since 2000. And what we've demonstrated is that the proportion of people that have died as a result of violence has actually decreased over the period of time. Although, as your readers could see from our report, if they went to our website, the rate of death has not actually declined overall over the last few years. So although the civilians are certainly caught up in all of the consequences of the conflict, displacement has been a significant problem in eastern Congo, particularly over the last 12 months in the North Kivu region. I think Alyosha mentioned there have been 400,000 people displaced in that region alone. But there are still many people who have not been displaced in the east, who still have limited access to basic services, for whom their economies have been disrupted, whose livelihoods have been significantly disrupted, and it's children who suffer disproportionately from these effects. And they represented actually 50% of all deaths in our most recent study.
But also a high number of women. They've been targets of violence over the last 10 years or so?
Absolutely. So widespread rape has been used as a weapon of the conflicts out in the East. In fact, our program on gender-based violence has provided services to over 40,000 survivors of sexual violence over the last 2 years. We did not specifically look at the issue of sexual violence in our survey. We only looked at mortality. But it is nonetheless one of the major problems in the East right now, and has been a particular problem with the escalation of violence in North Kivu.
Are child soldiers also a problem there?
Alyosha is closer to that right now and better placed to answer that, I think.
Alyosha?
Absolutely. The phenomenon of child soldiers is unfortunately a characteristic of this conflict. I can't speak specifically about North Kivu and this current round of conflict, but one of the things that the International Rescue Committee has been doing over the last few years is working with the demobilization and reintegration of former child combatants or other children associated with the armed forces across the very large northeastern province, Provence Orientale, and this involved us in a whole range of work, tracing, first of all, family members of these children, many of whom were combatants, many of whom were also just camp followers or young sexual partners of the combatants themselves. An awful lot of very, very traumatized children came out of that experience. And this experience, I think, is mirrored across a whole range of other conflicts that have taken place across the Congo in the last few years. Very much a part of the tragedy of this conflict and its aftermath.
Well, those girls were...
That's also one that is... I'm sorry.
You finish what you were going to say.
No, I just wanted to say also, not without stories of hope as well amongst all of that, and I think some of the most rewarding work that we have been able to do over the last few years is precisely this reunification of children who've maybe spent 5, 6, 7 years separated from their families by the fortunes and misfortunes of war.
Although I read a report in the New York Times recently about a boy who had been kidnapped by a rebel group and fought with them and then left that group and joined the government forces. He's still 17 or 18 years old. So he's a professional soldier, in effect, and he started when he was 13 or 14.
Absolutely, and we see, in fact, if we look at some of the other conflicts where child soldiers have been a key phenomenon or a key aspect of that conflict, we see, you know, 5, 6, 7 years on, this starts to pose a tremendous problem for the stability of the country if their needs and their experiences are not addressed and are catered for. So it remains a very important part of many conflicts, not least in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's certainly something that we at the International Rescue Committee do take very, very seriously.
Richard Brennan, where does the number of 45,000 people dead each month come from? Who conducted that survey?
Well, teams from the IRC. I was one of the co-lead investigators on the study, and we had teams that spread out right across all 11 provinces of the Congo. We visited 14,000 households in 700 communities across the country. In each community, we visited 20 households. and we asked about the experiences of births and deaths over the previous 16-month period. From that, we're able to calculate a rate at which people are dying, and then from that, we subtract the average rate of mortality for sub-Saharan Africa, and we can determine how many people are dying per month above and beyond that, which is normally experienced in sub-Saharan Africa. We've done that to be conservative, frankly, because the reported rates of death in Congo prior to the war were actually lower than those currently reported for Africa as a whole. And so our estimates, we believe, are conservative. And each time we have done these studies, we have made some assumptions and made some extrapolations, which have consistently been conservative. And that's how we've been able to come up with this updated estimate of 5.4 million excess deaths since August 1998.
Do people in Congo trust aid workers?
I believe so. I think that we went out to... I was on the ground myself for 6 weeks in Congo, and we, by and large, received a very warm reception. We ourselves operate in 7 provinces throughout the country. We're supporting in our health programs over 280 health facilities. And we were very well received. I think people have appreciated the longer-term commitment of agencies such as our own that have been on the ground there throughout the conflict. And in fact, we have used the data ourselves from our own studies to expand our programs, and other organizations have taken advantage of that data as well. So I think that by and large, we received almost universally a good reception. When we went to people's households, less than 1% of households refused to participate. And in fact, when we went into villages, oftentimes people would gather around us. It would create quite a buzz. And we would have to ask people politely to back off because, of course, you want to keep sensitive questions about deaths in particular confidential and provide people with privacy. So, and we got a lot of support from local health authorities who were provided invaluable assistance for our very, very, very difficult field work. So, yes, I think people the humanitarian agencies have been well received.
How, since you're the health director of all of the IRC, how would you compare the situation in Congo with crises in other parts of the world?
Well, in terms of the mortality rates, we have certainly seen similar rates in other countries. But when those elevated rates are applied to a country of the size of Congo, we're going to get a much higher total number of deaths than we've seen in other crises, such as perhaps Sierra Leone or Darfur, for example, Liberia, and so on.
Now, Alyosha, how dangerous is it for you?
Well, the International Rescue Committee takes security of its staff and its the partners with which we work very, very seriously. I mean, in the 3.5 years that I've been here, I've been through two. There have been three major short-term conflicts that have taken place in areas in which the IRC has an office. I personally have been in two of those three short-term sieges, if you like, and have, along with my colleagues, spent a certain amount of time lying on the floor contemplating the quality of the concrete. But other than that, by and large, we have a very, very positive operating environment. We take security very seriously. We only travel into areas if we've checked out the security that very day. We maintain very good contacts with a whole network of humanitarian agencies working here, the United Nations, local partners, the Ministry of Health, and all the other institutions and communities with which we work. And that really helps to guide our decisions about where we go. We're currently, at the moment, working in one health zone in North Kivu, in the area that has been affected by conflict over the last year. We began working there really in a very hot period of the conflict back in October of last year. This is coincidentally one of the health zones that is actually picked out in the mortality survey that that Dr. Brennan has just been describing, which is available on the IRC.org website, if your listeners are interested in downloading and sort of looking at this in more detail. And in that health zone, Rwanguba health zone, we've been operating in an area in which there are four armed groups are active at the same time, or have been active at the same time. And that really has complicated our work. We've had to make some difficult decisions about when to go and visit specific health centres or hospitals. And we've been able to cross between the different areas controlled by different factions by very, very clearly explaining what we do, who we are, the fact that we're here to help the population, that we're not involved, we're unbiased, we're neutral vis-a-vis their disagreements with each other. And by and large, this has worked. We've tended to reduce the length, we've tended to provide shorter duration supplies of medicines to make sure that health centers don't become a target because they've got large stocks of medicine and so on. So we've tailored the way we work to really minimize the risks to the people working in those health centers and to the population going to those health centers, and also, of course, to our own staff who are visiting them.
Are you hopeful that this peace deal that was signed yesterday between the government and the rebel Tutsi leader will actually change things or make things a little better at least?
Well, we sincerely hope so. It's still early in the process, and it is no doubt going to be a tough process. And I think it's very, very important that the entire international and domestic communities involved in this, all the stakeholders in this, really need to stay the course. It's very, very important that the U.S. government, European Union governments that have been so important in helping to broker this peace deal, stay engaged diplomatically and as financial supporters of this peace process and of the developmental work that is necessary to really bring stability to that area. So we're very hopeful that things will settle down and that will allow people to return to their homes and will allow essential medical supplies to go into those areas, will allow people to start getting back to some semblance of a normal life. So there's everything to play for here, and we're really, as the International Rescue Committee, as with all the other humanitarian players here, we're watching this very, very closely and hoping for the best.
Should I assume that Congo's neighbors in the area, Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi, are happy to see this sort of thing happen, or do they have their own interests in this conflict?
I think at this point in time, stability in North Kivu is good for stability, is a positive thing and will lend stability to the whole region. The more instability there is in eastern Congo, the more possibilities there are for armed groups, for arms, for illegal flows of minerals to move about, and that acts as a stimulus to destabilization in neighboring areas, both within the Congo and without. So I think it's very, very important, and in everybody's interest to see stability.
Is everybody dependent totally on humanitarian agencies? Is there still any agriculture there, or are there other things that are providing people food and medicine other than NGOs?
There's on the agriculture side, there certainly is. This is a very rich and fertile area from an agricultural point of view. Eastern Congo borders the Great Lakes of Africa, and this is like I said, a very rich and fertile area. So if people are left to their own devices, they have the capacity to feed themselves and to look after themselves at some basic subsistence level. Then, if we're talking about medicines and the access to healthcare, at this point in time, the role of external parties like non-governmental organizations, like donor governments, and the flow of external resources into the Congo is absolutely necessary. When we're looking at a humanitarian crisis of this magnitude, as our survey has shown, you're not going to turn that situation around without a serious injection of resources. And clearly some of those resources can come from and should and will come from the Congo itself. As I said before, it's very resource rich, but those resources need to be tapped, and the revenue from that needs to be channeled.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately, Alyosha, because we've run out of time. We have a link to the IRC's Congo program website on our show page at WNYC.org, and my great thanks to Alyosha D'Onofrio, who has been speaking to us from Bukavu, Congo, and Richard J. Brennan, Health Director of the IRC. All week we've been hearing about the dramatic declines in stock markets around the world. On tomorrow's Please Explain, how the various markets interact. Also, BAM's new production of Samuel Beckett's Happy Days. Then two actors from the Broadway hit August, Osage County. And we will hear about the new Romanian film, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. It's gotten great reviews. And be sure to check out the latest in our Political Projections film series. You're invited to a special film screening. Find out more on our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Scott Goldberg, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Fran Jacobs, and Leslie Dickstein. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We will see you tomorrow.